Welcome along to a special edition of the ITV Racing Podcast. I'm Emmett Kennedy alongside my colleague, Kevin Blake.
Hello.
ITV Racing's Irish expert and my colleague on the Final Furlong Podcast. And we are joined by ITV Racing's and an in-form red-hot trainer and a Royal Ascot legend in Johnny Murta.
That's very nice.
Sounds good.
You can pay me that fiver later on. I am cheap. Johnny, just to kick things off, you kind of led the international invasion of Royal Ascot by riding Choisir back in 2003 when he completed the King Stand and Diamond Jubilee double. He was 33-1 on the day. When you got the ride on that horse, did you fancy him? Did you genuinely think this horse could win?
I didn't know much about him, but I seen his videos and I seen him win down the straight in Melbourne. You know, he was racing around round tracks. He was running over seven. He was running over a mile. It didn't look like he was staying, but he had one real good piece of form, which was down the straight track in Melbourne. So I thought the track would suit him. I rang Damien Oliver in Australia and I asked him how good he was. And he said, he's tough, he's hardy. He's not top class over here, but he was of the same opinion. He would love the straight track in Ascot. And when he came here, well, when I seen him first, I thought, God, he was a big bull of a horse. He was pulling the old guy that was leading him round the parade ring. And he's had these eye shields on him, which is very uncommon for horses running in Ascot. But they were to settle him down. And the trainer gave me the leg up and he says, you know, he's got two speeds, Johnny. He's got very slow and very fast. So I had to take him down to the start very, very steadily. But it was all over after going. I knew after going a furlong, it was all over.
And could you have imagined, because like, he almost looked like the fly walking around with those eye shields. It was a very strange thing for us to see. But could you have imagined that when he completed that double for you, that that would propel the international invasion of Royal Ascot, that we then see so many Australian runners, the Wesley Ward, the American horses coming over? Could you have imagined that that would then kickstart this revolution?
I couldn't have imagined he was going to run him again in a couple of days later when he said it to me. You know, that wasn't the done thing for Group 1 horses, you know, to run them. Okay. If you have a handicapper, you know, and you might run them 3 days or twice in Galway. But these Group 1 horses never done that. But that's the way the Australian trained them. They start them off at 5 and he stepped them up to 6. He won the Golden Jubilee a couple of days later and he was better. And he told me he'd be better. So, no, to answer your question, I didn't think it was going to get as big as it was. But Ascot kind of jumped on the back of that. They're going around now. They're targeting horses that they think will suit the meeting. And it's great. It's really great to have the internationals here because we can match up against the best of the Aussies, the best of the Americans, the French, the Germans. So like, this is where it's at. If you want to be top of the world, you know, you have to turn up in Ascot. The history's there, the Queen is there, everything British is here, and it shows yesterday by the winners, you know, the coming from America, being bred in America, coming here. It shows how much it means to them.
And Johnny, I suppose that one of the keys to Choisir kickstarting the whole thing was, like you say, and I remember reading it at the time, he wasn't considered the best sprinter in Australia by any means, but the fact that he came up and won, I suppose, gave the Australians a real... The little monkeys in their head started churning the wheels, you know, and thinking that, God, this is something that we can do, you know, with our better sprinters. If Choisir can go and win twice, you know, we can really have a go, and I suppose that probably helped stimulate the whole thing to get going to what it is now.
Yeah, because he wasn't one of their top sprinters at the time. But the key thing, sometimes you can bring their top sprinters over. Ascot's a bit different. You know, I think you have to have form down the straight in Melbourne because a lot of their races are around the bend, you know, even 5-6 furlongs around the bend. But you have to have the form with the Melbourne straight course and then it can carry on to here. But they have come in their droves in recent years and it's just a pity they didn't bring over Winx this year.
I was going to say it. Kevin turned to me after the Queen Anne yesterday and said, I wonder what the connections of Winx are thinking now.
Yeah, so it was really disappointing. You know, at the end of the day, like it never made sense, we'll say, for Black Caviar to come over. You know, she had technically had nothing to prove either, but they made the brave decision, and she's an absolute legend now, around the world. You know, whereas Winx, for me, with that decision, you know, they've had the option for 3 or 4 years now to bring her over. They haven't done it. And for me, she'll just be remembered as an Aussie legend now. She could have come over. And even with a substandard field, if she came over and blew those away, she's a world superstar. Yeah. No one would ever forget her. But now they took the easy decision. You know, in many ways, a sensible decision. But, you know, they're racehorses. You know, be brave. That's how you build a legacy.
And Royal Ascot is a truly international meeting. Speaking of famous racehorses, one of the most famous to ever race here was Yates, and you won on him as the first jockey to Aidan O'Brien in the Ascot Gold Cup to complete the four-timer, the historic four-timer. But you were telling me before that you didn't really fancy him And in fact, you didn't really fancy him until he went under the arch at Royal Ascot.
That's what he was. The fourth year, the pressure was on. He didn't run particularly well in Navan, but the ground was soft that day. Seamus Heffernan rode him that day, and he said he was happy with him. He finished fifth. Aidan O'Brien was very, but no, that's perfect. Now we'll get him home and we'll train him for Ascot. You know, we'll get him ready for Ascot. I rode him at homework beforehand and he went well. But when he got to Ascot and he walked around the ring and he came out under the arch, he knew where he was. He just knew where he was. He knew there was a job on. I kicked early that year because there was Pacti was supposed to be this young, up-and-coming superstar. I says, well, he's going to have to run very hard the last two furlongs to catch me, because Yates was just relentless. He got this great, powerful stride, great heart, great lungs. And it was... I felt a little bit pressure that day, but not for myself, for the horse. I really wanted him to do it because no horse had done it before. He deserved to do it. But when he walked under the arch, I knew he was game on.
I remember your celebration that day. You were looking to the sky and you were throwing your hands up when he did it. Like, he is now an iconic Royal Ascot horse, and he was bred to win a Derby, and he obviously missed Epsom, and things didn't quite go to plan in his three-year-old career. But it was very sporting of Coolmore to continue to race him, to go for those four races. And the fact that he then managed to go and achieve that, like, it must be something that you're very proud of, to be part of that Royal Ascot legacy.
It is. You know, there is, as you said, the legacy. There's loads of legacies around Ascot. There's loads of little pieces of history around Ascot. And to be part of that was great. There's not many other horses have the bronze in the middle of the parade ring in Ascot. Yeah. So that's very special. So every time I walk by it, you get a little wry smile of saying, I was the lucky one to be associated with that great horse.
And Johnny, at the time, you would have been in Ballydoyle a lot, I'm sure. How big of a job did Aidan do training him to bring a full horse back year after year? Was he a handful at home, or did he make it easy for Aidan?
He was a handful at home. The one rider was on him all the time. But after he ran in Navan, Aidan never wavers. He never wavered. He says, that's grand. He'll be fine for Ascot. I'll get him ready for Ascot. And that's what he does. He gets them ready for Ascot.
And I can only imagine the preparation for a horse to run in the Gold Cup must be quite brutal in a way, because, you know, 2.5 miles, the conditioning program, and for a full horse of whatever he was, what was he in the end, 7 years old, 8 years old? I can only imagine he would have been. And I think from memory, it was a roundy horse, wasn't he? He carried plenty of condition.
He was a huge horse, big horse. So, yes, but he had a great heart, great lungs. He was very, very sound. And he was an ideal horse for Aidan. You know, he was an ideal horse for Aidan. Like, Aidan leaves no stone unturned. And when they turn up in the big races, you just know they're ready to run the lights out.
There was a lot of talk about his campaigning and that would he ever run in an arc. He never did, but Order of St. George has. And you could argue that he could be going for three in a row today. He's had the class to be placed in an arc. What do you make of his preparation? What do you make of his chance to win his second Ascot Gold Cup on ITV on Thursday?
I think he's a great chance. I think his preparation has gone really well this year. He looks a bit more straightforward. Before, they used to have to drop him in and get him relaxed and get him doing things right. Now they're just sitting him just in behind the pace. You know, I think he's a very uncomplicated horse. He was very unlucky last year. He should have won. So I can see him being a big danger. It's a very good Gold Cup today. Yeah. Stradivarius is a very good horse. The Aga Khan's horse is a big danger. If Stradivarius and Order St. George lock horns, he'll be sitting, waiting to pounce, and Sumio won't come too early. He'll wait. He's top class. He'll love riding this kind of race. He'll be showing everybody how good he is. He'll come there inside the furlong pole. If he's going really well, he'll probably look over at the other two. But he's a very, very classy horse.
He's also a bit of a legend of a jockey. Like, he just exudes confidence. I mean, remember that famous image of him looking back to the opposition in the arc on Delacani and waving them on. Come on, can you come past me? Like, he will relish the big occasion.
He is. He's a top-class jockey. He's, you know, great jockey, great man for the big day. You know, there's no surprise that the same jockeys win the big races all the time.
Another big man for the big occasion, Aidan O'Brien. He's already been champion trainer here 8 times. He's been champion trainer for the last 3 years. Didn't have the best of days on day one, obviously, but still a lot of firepower to come. What is it that makes Aidan O'Brien such a special trainer? There's a big feature on ITV this week with AP McCoy at Ballydoyle. But what separates him? What makes him so good? Because people would say, oh, he's given these blue bred horses every year. He trains champion juveniles, champion sprinters, champion stayers. What is it that separates him from the rest?
He gets all the best horses, okay. But he doesn't miss with them. His attention to detail is brilliant. he's got a lot of aids at his disposal, heart monitors, heart rates, you know, that tracker system in Ballydoyle. But he trains by his eye. He trains what he sees. He doesn't miss anything. He's just a very, very natural horseman. And the system is in Ballydoyle. The system is in place. He doesn't change the system. And if a horse is not able to do that, they don't win the big races. So they have. He puts them through that. And he's done it so many times. And he's trained so many great horses. That, like as I said, for a jockey, when you turn up on the big day, there's no doubt. I wonder, is this fella fit? I wonder, will he stay? That's gone out of your mind. You just know, I'm the best horse. And if I get to the 2 furlong marker, he's going to run the last two very strong. It's going to take something special to beat him.
And just to bring it back to something you said there, Johnny, about big race jockeys, because I'm really interested in this. Me, myself and Emmett were only talking about this on the walk and the way up. The things that separate a really, really good jockey from a Group 1 big occasion jockey, because we see, you know, the ultimate example with Frankie yesterday. He's been a world-class jockey for 25 years, but he seems to grow on the big occasions. And I'm sure, well, I can think of examples myself of guys that are brilliant around the smaller tracks, but they maybe don't have quite the same confidence on the very biggest occasion. You know, how important do you think that is? You said there that it tends to be the same faces win the big races. Is that a part of that?
I think it is. It's hard to break into it, and you're not going to get many chances. So when you get those chances, you better take them, because they're not going to come up very often. And the likes of a Frankie or a Soumillon or a Pellier or a Ryan Moore, if they mess up, they might get another chance. But a smaller jockey, if he messes up, he's gone off it, and the bigger lads get on it. So it's hard to break into it. But on the big day, you need just, the more relaxed you are, the better. And you have to ask yourself, like I say to myself, I've put in all the work. This is where I want to be. This is where I deserve to be. And there's no way I'm going to let this chance pass.
So for you, the relaxation comes from preparation, a feeling I can't have done any more than I've done. And that relaxes you.
And I suppose when you go home at night, you have to be very brutally honest when you're looking at the reruns. And even sometimes you win the big races. Could I have done anything better today? Or could I have done any more today? And if you're really honest with yourself, you'll know. And there was nobody coaching me. I was my biggest critic. I was my biggest critic, and I was the hardest person in the world to please. So even on the good days, I'd say, maybe I could have done that a bit better. Maybe I should have done this a bit better. But as you said, the preparation goes in, you do your form. And the big thing for me, if you could just visualise, like I used to go running every day and I could visualise the races. I'd be given the interview, the winning interview after the races. That's the way I'd be thinking. And sometimes it would happen exactly the way I thought it, and other times it wouldn't. So then you have to say, right, I have to be very flexible. If it's not falling my way today, I have to, you know, not wing it, but you wing it. You have to wing it. You just have to play the way, you know, it's not falling right today. Okay, oh God, what am I going to do now? Right, not falling my way today. Relax.
Stay cool.
Still believe in my horse. Stay cool. Don't do anything stupid. Like, the biggest thing to do when you're in those big races, do what you're doing every day. Don't think, oh, I'm going to do something special today because it's a Group 1. Keep it very, very simple. Back to basics. Balanced. Good position. Left hand, right hand. And listen, the riding, I always found the riding in the big races was easy because all the best jockeys were in it. Great horses. You knew everybody. You knew what to do. You know, you could read the form very well. A race like the Hunt Cup today now would be a nightmare to try and prepare for.
Yeah.
You know, but the big races, the big Group 1s, you could nearly see what's going to happen before it happened.
You were a very confident jockey, and that obviously then would have translated to your equine talent as well. Whatever horse you were on would sense that confidence, which would obviously help very well. But when you were in the jockey room, when you were getting ready, could you see, as Kevin was talking about, what's the difference between a top-class jockey? Big name jockeys who are very successful on Saturdays, but now it's Royal Ascot and there's millions of people watching, 200 countries around the world watching. It's the big occasion. The horse has been prepped for the entire year for it. Could you see the nerves, the tension on the faces of your rivals?
You could, yeah. And that's what, like, Frankie's off to a great start, so he's flying. Other lads there didn't have a great start, so it starts getting a bit edgy. But Ascot is like that. It can be soul destroying. You know, if you just go left and the gap opens right. You know, and I'm not saying they're bad jockeys. It's just, it doesn't happen for you at the right time. but the big jockeys seem to make less and less mistakes. They seem to make the right decision all the time. But come the big day, the more relaxed you are and the more confidence you have in yourself, you know, it emanates down into the horse, and they sense that.
So let's find out then about the horses that you're confident about for the rest of the week then at Royal Ascot. We're recording this on Wednesday, so no pressure on you, Johnny. You're an in-form trainer banging in the winners, but can you bang in the winners in terms of tipping? So who are you really fascinated to see on ITV this week?
I'm looking forward to seeing Vizrabad against the two hot pots. I think he's a definite big player. The coronation, Clemmy now, again, she has a lot to do, but she was a very good two-year-old. And if Aidan has her anywhere back to where she was last year, I think she's a big player in the coronation.
How do you think they'll have felt about her preparation, given the fact that she was beaten so far? But surely, given the interrupted preparation she had, that would have all been about coming along today. I'm just leading it back to what he said about Yates. Oh, that's grand. That's fine. Like, would they have taken that attitude with her as well?
I'm sure they would. I hate interrupted preparations. It's, you know, it's not great for the big occasions, but she has had a run now, and although she was disappointing in the Irish Guineas, I'll bring her home now. I'll get her ready for Royal Ascot. That'll be Aidan's. And if she turns up here, I'm sure she'll be ready to run like the old Clemmy of old. The big sprint, what's the good horse of Godolphin's? That's everybody.
Harry's Angel.
If he behaves, he is a great chance. But speaking to David Hayes, he thinks he's coming over with that Australian
Red Kirk Warrior.
He thinks he's in good shape, and he's a horse that has won down the straight in Melbourne. So it's very, very interesting. As I said, I haven't looked too far ahead of the week. If I was to give you one, I think at a bit of a price is Vizrabad in the Gold Cup.
Okay, I'm liking that. Kevin, we'll have to get your selections as well, because you've had more time to study the racing since we did the first ITV Racing podcast at the start of the week with Ed and Cheska.
Well, I better stick. Ed put me on the spot yesterday for the best bet on air of the week, so I better stick with it. Downdraft in the King George V handicap on Thursday.
And you've already nailed LA Goes to Vegas or Lagos to Vegas. There's a huge debate going on as to what is the pronunciation of this horse's name.
It's not a huge debate. She's called Lagos to Vegas.
What did Atsini and Willie Mullen say? They were saying Lagos to Vegas. Yeah, so this LA Goes to Vegas thing has to be put to bed. So you're sticking with Downdraft. I will go with... Ooh, actually, you know what? I'm going to go with Idaho. I think Idaho is going to turn the tables on and win back-to-back Hardwicks. Yeah, I'm going to stick with him. It is. Actually, the nap of the week is Sioux Nation in the Commonwealth Cup, so I'll stick with him as well. One final question for you. When you made the decision to retire from race riding, and I assume you knew you were going to be a trainer, how was the transition from being a jockey and that day-to-day routine and having to starve yourself, essentially, to always remain fit and to be able to do the weight, to then switch to media and to be a successful trainer?
It was pretty straightforward, because I was doing a bit of training as well as riding the last year I was there, you know, so I knew what I was getting into. I really enjoyed the training part of it. I was happy at first to lose the madness of not eating and running the tracks, but sometimes I miss it.
Really?
I miss the madness. I had a very structured life, you know. I was very restricted in what I could eat, but I love being a trainer. I love the daily routine. The work is hard, it's long. When I was a jockey, I had all the power when it really mattered. Now as a trainer, I hand over all the power.
All the
I hand all the power over to a jockey. So, but that's the way it is. I've got good people around me. I don't blame any jockeys, because I booked them 3 days ago. So it's not their fault. It's your fault. If you didn't think he was good enough in the first place, you shouldn't have got him.
I was going to say, because Roy Keane, one of his failings as a manager was he couldn't understand why players weren't as good as him. And he would be looking at guys in training going, what's going on here, boy? Like, I actually know what I'm doing. So you don't have that attitude then to jockeys, that if it doesn't go right, you're not going, oh, God, I'd have done that completely differently.
Well, I do a bit, I suppose. I do a bit. But not as much now. As I said, I booked them. So if I don't have confidence in them booking them, why am I doing it? You know, when I booked him at the time, I believe he's the right jockey for the right horse. So people trusted me with their horses. I just have to trust people with my horses.
Johnny, for a fella that spent his whole career starving himself, obviously, you haven't blown up now since you've retired. Are you still doing exercise, or do you still keep a bit of a diet? Or
I'm eating everything. I'm eating Chinese, I'm eating chips, I'm eating everything. But I'm very busy and I'm very active. And I like being busy and I like being active. It keeps me, you know, keeps me kind of on the straight and narrow. So, no, I'm 10 stone now. So I put on just over a stone, but I feel great. And my wife told me if two, you know, you can either get really big or stay the way you are, but you know, you decide. So I think I'm happy the way I am with me. I'm still pretty fit. I'm still active, and I'm still riding out.
Well, if I can get myself back down to 10 stone, I'll be absolutely thrilled and loving life. But I think that's a very unlikely one to happen. Final question for you: for the rest of the season, what are you most looking forward to as a trainer, as a racing fan, as a racing enthusiast, as a broadcaster? What are you most looking forward to?
Well, I thought this year my target was to have a group winner. So we had a group winner last week. True Valor won the Group 3 at Leopardstown. So personally, I'd like to build up my profile as a trainer. I'd like to get into better horses. And for racing, racing was very good to me. So anything I can do to promote it or to, you know, to make people come more racing, because it's a brilliant sport. It's a brilliant sport. The horses are the real stars, probably. You know what I mean? They are the real stars, and they're so brilliant of animals. It's only when you're around them so much you appreciate how great they are, how beautiful they are, how graceful they are. And they can't speak, but there's signs there telling you how they are. So you just have to pick up the signs. But if people come and racing for the first time, you know, if you get bitten by the bug, it's just with you forever. You just can't leave it. So I want racing to be on the front pages of the papers for all the right reasons. And anything I can do to promote that or to help that, that's the best I can do.
And no better man for the job. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, Johnny. You can see Johnny's analysis throughout the week on ITV Racing with the Ed Cheska and the entire team.
But Kevin, he's finished after today.
I know, actually. I was like, Johnny's going to be escaping back home today. But you're going to be back on ITV later in the year throughout the summer.
Yes, hopefully. I've got Leopardstown tomorrow. So back to the day job tomorrow. But I do enjoy it. I do enjoy it. And I do feel part of the big day still. You know, when you retire, if you were home now, I wouldn't have any runners in Ascot, or I mightn't have any runners in Ascot, I mightn't be here. So it's great to be still here, feeling the buzz, you know, right in the middle of the parade ring, meeting people I rode against or trainers I rode for. So it's great, and I really appreciate being part of the ITV, you know, top-class group, and get to meet you two guys in the podcast.
Yeah, sorry about lumbering you with that one.
made my week.
Cut that. That's our promo. Johnny, absolute pleasure talking to you. The ITV coverage continues for Royal Ascot throughout the week as we're on ITV and ITV4. Kevin and I are back on the opening show with Ollie Bell and Rishi Prasad in the mornings from 9:30. Coverage begins at 1:30 on the days, and we'll do another ITV Racing podcast for you before Royal Ascot ends. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. From Kevin, from Johnny, and from me, Emma Kennedy, we'll talk to you again very, very soon on the ITV Racing podcast.